This is the start of our next class session. Comments or questions before we move on? As you develop your pictograms and your words that you derive from that, whatever you do, feel free to email them to me and I'll collect them at lunchtime and we'll comment on them after lunch. So, any questions or comments before we move on? Well, then let's move on. You may have noticed, if you're doing this by computer, which I hope you are, that I've put some artwork up on the screen.
Sorry.
William Blake, these are paintings and drawings by William Blake. Blake lived from 1757 to 1827. He was a poet, a painter, and a printmaker. He earned his living primarily as an etcher. He's known today for his art and his poetry, even though he was virtually unknown and unregarded while he was alive. And in terms of poetry, especially the poems of innocence and the poems of experience, his best-known poem is The Tiger. Tiger, tiger, burning bright in the forests of the night, what immortal hand or eye could frame thy fearful symmetry? In what distant deeps or skies burnt the fire of thine ease? That's eyes. On what wings dare he aspire, what the hand dare seize the fire? And what shoulder and what art could twist the sinews of thy heart? And when thy heart began to beat, what dread hand and what dread feet? What the hammer, what the chain, in what furnace was thy brain? What the anvil, what dread grasp, there its deadly terrors clasp? When the stars threw down their spears and watered heaven with their tears, did he smile his work to see? Did he who made the lamb make thee? Tiger, tiger, burning bright in the forest of the night, what immortal hand or eye there framed thy fearful symmetry? And I put up some examples of this painting, and I've got a few more to show you. This one is the great geometer god as a with a compass, working from on high to create creation. And then this next one you may or may not be familiar with. The first one, of course, is the cover of Love Virtue, so you're familiar with it. This one is a prayer that is two angels in the shape of praying hands. And there's a person laying down here. So it creates the equilateral triangle with the light coming forth right at the apex of the triangle, right between the heads of the angels, and their wings going up to higher realms of divine. And it's quite a illustration. Let's see here. We've got some more. This is Jacob's Ladder. And this is the Annunciation, the angels appearing to the shepherds in the field. Try to expand it. And then one more.
It has a face here. You see that?
Right. Up at the top of the one, Jacob's Ladder, is a face, a visage, from which all the saints are using the ladder. And let's see. And then Pegasus. I'll expand this. Everybody able to see these?
Yes, looks good.
This is Pegasus. And so he...
Where are his wings?
I think
that's his tail.
Well, he's converted the tail into the wings. fanciful, of course. So he was very accomplished in his artwork and very much in anticipation of about 100 years ahead of his time in terms of his artwork. Obviously, those up. Of course, our everybody should have gotten the Proverbs of Hell that I sent out and printed it out. There's an enormous body of work of Blake's writing, both poetry and prose, that we're not familiar with and is not taught in school. And as you know, one of my complaints about modern education is that it anthologizes one or two great works by a well-known poet or writer or whatever, and you read that, and that's it. You don't have any idea of the other works of Edgar Allan Poe or William Blake or Alexander Pope or anybody else, and so the work of Sophie is to bring attention back to some of those non-anthologized pieces and obscure pieces that otherwise only English professors read and are quite important and delightful. So Blake wrote a piece called The Marriage of Heaven and Hell, which is largely prose, some poetry in it. And it includes the Proverbs of Hell. The idea here is that hell is actually earth, heaven is the ideal. As we gain experience in dealing with the vicissitudes of life on earth, hell, we're supposed to learn certain lessons. And we learn the lessons of heaven if we look for the ideal within the problem. So he has distilled a number of proverbs, which he calls Proverbs of Hell, but they're really proverbs designed to indicate the lessons of life. And so, for example, the number one is, in seed time learn, in harvest teach, in winter enjoy. And so I'm just going to go through and pick out a few of these, like that one, and ask for your comments and interpretations and whether that makes a good proverb or not. What do you make of that? In seed time learn, in harvest teach, in winter enjoy.
It's cycles of life.
Okay. And more than that, what about them?
Within a year or a period of time, there's a time for contemplation, a time for action, etc.
Okay. What about the process of, or the progress of learn, teach, enjoy? Okay. Okay, any other insights? Rose?
This is similar. I would just say that by teaching what you learned, that is where your joy and fulfillment can come from.
Okay, by teaching what you learned, your joy and fulfillment arise. Okay. Anybody else?
Just what about once you learn something and you teach it, and reinforcing your learning, so it brings you to another level of learning and therefore enjoying it more, I guess.
Okay. All right. I would direct your attention to the word seed. You know that one of the ideas of thinking is to plant, the soul plants seeds in your mind. They develop, they mature. Then you harvest them when you become aware of them. You share them with others. And as a result, you tap the joy of the soul. So this is the process of seeding the mind. Your mind, others. The whole concept of teaching is seeding. You can't force any child to learn. You have to plant seeds and let them grow. You do your best to nurture them, to help them develop. But there's no way you can impose a lesson or wisdom on a child. You have to plant a seed. And then they have to nurture it, develop it, share it with others. And it's in this process that the ultimate reward of this is joy. But the enjoy in the sense of God doing the 7 days of creation at the end of every day, pausing, looking at what he had done and saying, this is good. A radiance of joy beyond our capacity to imagine or register. And so joy is inherent in the purpose behind seeding and harvesting. It's not just that we should have fun. I realize that fun is part of fundamental, but as I said earlier, we're meant to become channels of joy in life. See how wonderful a proverb can be? And I definitely envision teaching, using proverbs, A, to help children learn to read, and B, to help them learn to think. How about the number two? Drive your cart and your plow over the bones of the dead. What does that mean? See, the easy part is the word recognition. The easy part of reading is word recognition. I'm a good reader. Drive your cart and your plow over the bones of the dead. And in most schools, once you can do that out loud, verbally, whatever, you get a star for being a good reader. And they never ask the question I just asked, what the hell does that mean? These are proverbs of hell, so what the hell does that mean?
I would say that it's using the lessons of the past and integrating that into your life and moving forward.
Okay.
I feel like the idea that it says drive your heart and your heart, so it's the individual's action. You know, you're taking action and maybe incorporating the past.
What are the bones of the dead? Well, maybe just the last cycle. I mean, you plow up the field, the farmer plows the field to turn over the stubble left from the harvest a year ago. So it may not be bad ideas or worn out ideas, but they're the bones of the dead, Rose.
Yeah, I would just say that the cart and the plow would be your skills and talents. And then, like you say, you use those to update yourself.
Okay, the cart and the plow are the skills and talents, and you use them to update. The bones of the dead are simply the foundation, as you indicate, mm-hmm. of what's gone before. The bones of the dead might be the traditions of humanity. It might be your ethnic heritage. It might be what you did last year. What did you do on summer vacation? The bones of the dead. And if you combine that with the concept of the seed, The bones of the dead represent the continuing element of life. The bones of the dead seem to us to be dead, but it's where we start from. The child entering school has brought with him or her whatever lessons in learning and life they have achieved in previous lives. So the bones of the dead are where you start from, not something to be plowed under, but they fertilize your efforts to grow.
So a current example of this would be Mammy's book.
Mammy's book?
Mammy's book. Mammy's
we'll get to that
book
this afternoon.
That we are reading.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's basically what he did.
Right. He plowed up the bones of the dead of liberalism.
Yeah.
Exactly. And we should see this as a dynamic process. We should not be afraid of the bones of the dead. We shouldn't bury them underground. We should take them and build. It's like this. Another example of this is if you remember my column a couple weeks ago on APO, the problem was that they had built a cafe, a bistro, on top of the probable location of the church in which St. John the Divine worked and wrote the book of Revelation. And that's very, very, the top is what they're looking for. Very common in Europe for a Catholic church to be built on the site of a Roman or a Greek church, a pagan church, a shrine to Apollo or something like that. And so they're building on the bones of the dead. How about number three? The road of excess leads to the palace of wisdom.
Sounds like the prodigal son.
Rose says it sounds like the prodigal son. Anybody care to comment on this one? Yeah. Okay, that would be the lesson of overdoing something. You learn to say enough, and so it leads you to the palace of wisdom. Notice the iconoclastic in-your-face kind of attitude of Blake here. This is not saying something that appeals to the normal morality of human beings. It is certainly not politically correct. It's saying if the drunken slob on the street is well on his way to wisdom, it's just a few lifetimes away. Homelessness is not a problem, it's part of the path to wisdom. You know, we used to romanticize the homeless, we called them hobos. And it's interesting to discuss it in those terms because a hobo to somebody else is a bum, but to a folk singer, to Bob Dylan or Pete Seeger, a hobo to Willie Nelson, that's the whole romance of life, is being a hobo, riding the rail, standing up to the railroad security agents. And so we now call them homeless.
Actually, he was expressing freedom.
Yes, one could. Rose just pointed out that the hobo or the bum or the homeless person is simply somebody trying to express their own freedom and grapple with their problems. The quote-unquote compassionate left, or the pseudo, the faux compassionate left is, oh, we must help this poor hobo. And as a result, they interfere in a person's life, often without their permission. So the road of excess has its place. It leads you into hell, but once you get through the hell of it, you are a step closer to wisdom. How about prudence is a rich, ugly old maid courted by incapacity?
Ew.
Isn't that a nice description of prudence? I mean, prude We've all known our share of prudes or prudes. Any commentary on that?
Oh, those three ladies.
Ah, yes, Opa. You saw it. Did you see it?
Yes, yes, those three ladies in black.
Yes, did you like it?
Oh, I loved it.
Yeah. Right. Yes, Prudence, Priggishness, and Priscilla, I think were their names. And notice the imagery here. Rich, ugly old maid. This is a person that is sterile, is removing themselves from society by condemning everybody else with their prudishness.
And so is the incapacity is the incapacity to love.
The incapacity to love,
which
to enjoy.
Shrivels up.
I would say it's the incapacity to enjoy, winner to enjoy. She's reached the winner of her life as a rich, ugly old maid who is incapable of doing anything. See how much, I mean, you can read a whole short story and not get as much as you get out of each one of these proverbs. That's the point of a proverb, is it condenses human experience into a single witty statement. He who desires but acts not breeds pestilence. Now, our modern attitude is just the opposite. He who lusts and acts upon it breeds syphilis. Yes?
Okay. If it's his desires, like you say, their his lustful desires.
Or greed or whatever.
Or whatever. He is actually creating those thought forms and sending them out into the world, which breeds pestilence.
Right.
They are misshapen thought forms of greed or lust or whatever.
Very good. I hope you heard that, Rose, is saying that he's creating thought forms of bastard thoughts. And compare this statement, he who desires but acts not breeds pestilence, to... You have been told that it's a sin to, oh dear, we're now running on reserve battery.
Can you plug yours into
mine? Yeah,
I'm
going to plug mine.
Well, this would be the absolute opposite of being told to be fruitful and multiply, would it?
Well, it's the opposite of that, but it's also, there's a statement by the Christ, you've been told that it's a sin to seduce your neighbor's wife or goat or whatever. And I say to you, if you have thoughts of lust in your heart, it's the same thing. So he's just taking that idea and emphasizing it. He who desires but doesn't act upon it is still breeding the pestilence of, that is the inner dimension of syphilis or gonorrhea or AIDS or whatever it might be. Yes.
Now, I remember in Catholic school when I was 6 years old or something, the nuns telling us that if we wore short shorts,
yes,
and the boys had any lustful thoughts of us, that we were sinners. We were causing those little boys to have sinful thoughts.
Well, I think that goes back to rich, ugly old maid. It's that type of guilt.
Telling that to a little kid who really didn't have a clue what she was talking about.
Right, right. There's an element of truth in that, but...
Yes, I know, but to tell that to somebody who has really no capacity to understand what she was saying...
Well, let's jump down here. We can't cover all 70 of these, but let's jump down and see what... Yes.
Well, that wouldn't breed a pestilence.
Well, there would be that element of it, but I don't think it's just, I think it's neutral. I don't think it's, it can apply to the positive and to the negative intention. Let's see, I'm trying to find one specific one, and of course out of 70 that's difficult. Oh, here it is, number 25. The nakedness of woman is the work of God. Now, when your nun told you that, you should have stood up and said, but William Blake says that nakedness of woman is the work of God. And the nun would have wrapped your knuckles with doing. How about prisons are built with stones of law, brothels with bricks of religion? Number 21. Prisons are built with stones of law, brothels with bricks of religion.
Sounds like a Dora Warner song.
Sounds like a country western song, huh? Any comment on that? Blake, by the way, was a libertarian. He was happily married. I don't think he availed himself of brothels, but he certainly thought that society's attitude of condemnation towards brothels and so on was very harmful and injurious to society. So prisons are built with human constructs, stones of law, and brothels with bricks of religion. And the idea is we wouldn't need brothels if religion wasn't such a prude about sex. And we wouldn't need prisons if people understood the law of spirit. Let's see. I'm sorry?
I mean, those are things that are going to get imposed on people.
Right. Now, for him to have thoughts like this back in the early 18th century, or the late 18th century, early 19th century, is he was way ahead of his time. And now, here we have one, number 23, the lust of the goat is the bounty of God. Notice he didn't say old goat, he just said goat. And he's saying here that the bounty of God is, of course, the abundance of life. Be fruitful and multiply, as Rose suggested earlier. How can goats be fruitful and multiply except through their sexual urges to reproduce? And of course, it's not really lust when a goat does it. It's lust when a man does it and is condemned by religion. How about 31? The bird, a nest, the spider, a web, man, friendship. I'm sorry? Speak up. Well, I would go a step further, and that's the natural tendency to create a home, and the true home of man is friendship, not the physical structure. As Emily Dickinson said, my estate, my friends are my estate. And that's almost a literal restatement of this concept. She counted her friendship as a far greater shelter than her physical home.
The word that came to my mind was sustenance.
Sustenance.
Each of those.
Oh, okay. Well, the nest doesn't really give the bird sustenance.
No,
it gives them a home, sense
yeah,
of home,
okay.
protection.
Okay.
The spider, we now know, but he probably had earlier information. He probably didn't know about, as much about spiders and their webs as we do. It appears to be a home.
Mm-hmm.
As the plow follows words, so God rewards prayers. Number 43. As the plow follows words, so God rewards prayers. Comments?
Well, I mean, farmers would be praying for their fields and their harvest. That would be the words. Would that be the words? And then God would hear their prayers or something like
that? Well, I don't think it's quite that literal. The, I think the phrase, as the plow follows words, means you start with words, you formulate a plan, and then you put it into action, you plow. And our prayer is a way in which we formulate a plan through which God can come into our life, the soul, the spirit. The fox provides for himself, but God provides for the lion. 40. I'm sorry, speak up, please. Oh, I don't know whether lions feed on foxes. I think the fox would be too fast.
Well, and the fox is sly.
From each according to his need.
Oh, that sounds awfully Marxist.
Well, the fox can provide for himself, and God can oversee him. Only help out if he needs to every now and then. But if the lion can't, you know, depending. Poor lion.
Okay, well, I think Rose has an interesting point here, and that is the fox is sly. You can provide for yourself through cunning, theft, etc., but the best way is to let God provide for you, and then you're the master. The lion is the king of the jungle. This is to be interpreted symbolically. God provides, the authority of God provides what anybody needs if you abandon your sly, cunning ways and do it forthrightly. Here's one of my favorites. One thought fills immensity. One thought fills immensity. Right. The extensiveness of the big idea. And read it in the context of number 35. This is 35 and 36. 35 is the cistern contains the fountain overflows,
so
the Titan's cup.
Talking about the mind of God.
Right. And then 36, one thought fills immensity. They go together. And so as Rose just said, we're talking about the mind of God here. We're talking about the Titan's cup as painted by Thomas Cole. The cistern contains the fountain overflows. And one thought fills immensely. One individual properly connected to the mind of God can influence mass consciousness, can make an impact on all fellow human beings. Because the thought fills immensely. Now that's a brilliant insight. Can you imagine learning that as a 4-year-old or a 5-year-old in Walnut Grove, one thought fills immensely, and discussing it and understanding what it means. We don't need to discuss it because all of our classes have echoed this premise, but this is William Blake speaking, writing 300 years ago, and obviously that makes it legitimate to bring it up in a class, in a school. We're not coming out and saying from on high about big ideas or whatever. We're quoting William Blake. One thought fills immensity. How can that be? What are the logical implications of that? What is the immensity? Yes. Very good. Expect poison from the standing water, number 45. Exactly. Stagnation is poison. Very good. Other comments? Yes. Right. How about number 47? Listen to the fool's reproach. It is a kingly title. Listen to the fool's reproach, it is a kingly title. Well, of course, this brings in the whole symbolism of the fool and the tarot. The fool is one that has a different perspective of Blake, William Blake. He's equating himself to the fool and saying, I am full of wisdom, and because of that, I look at life differently than you do, and you think I'm being foolish. You think I'm a madman. That's the way he was viewed by his contemporaries. Even Wordsworth called him a madman, but that he was a madman worth listening to. How about number 51? The thankful receiver bears a plentiful harvest. Now, that's not one for a book of 51. Exactly. How about 53? The soul of sweet delight can never be defiled. I'm sorry?
It doesn't sound like joy to me. You know, it's a good joy. It can never be defiled.
That's true. That's a good point. I think he's also got a far more mundane point that he's making. To me, sweet delight is probably his reference to the communion that occurs when two loving people have sex, like he and his wife, and the act of sex as he knew it can never be defiled. The joy that one can achieve when one approaches this unselfishly and lovingly can't be defiled no matter what society does in trying to do so. I like the next one especially, 54. When thou seest an eagle, thou seest a portion of genius, lift up thy head. Sounds like a motto for Walden Grove. Fifty-six, to create a little flower is the labor of ages.
Especially if it's in a cranny of wall.
Right, especially if it's found in a cranny wall. Yeah. Exactly. We take flowers for granted because nature grows them, but we fail to remember that these flowers have been millions of years in evolution. And so the ability to create, and we can be gardeners, but we can't create a flower. We can help them grow, but that's our limit. And this harkens back to this image of the seed. We plant seeds, and in order to bring them to fruition is the labor of ages. We should be patient, especially in dealing with others. How about number 61? Did you like that one? The head sublime, the heart pathos, the genitals beauty, and the hands and feet proportion. Yes, it sounds like an unexpurgated version of the Four of Pentacles. The head sublime, the heart pathos, the genitals beauty, the hands and feet proportion. And when you go back and look at, I don't have it up anymore, but the very first, the cover of Love Virtue, the artwork from there, I'll bring it back up. It's pretty clear from this that Blake is saying the design of the human being is not an error on the part of God. Every aspect of human function is meant to express something divine, including the sacral center. And keep in mind, he was doing this 200 years before Freud, and humanity was pretty well messed up when it came to understanding sexuality. Still is. Sure. Absolutely. And here we come up with a commentary on the earlier one. If the lion was advised by the fox, he would be cunning. And of course, that's a reference to the little foxes in the wilderness that we have to take care to eliminate the vixens in our subconscious. So if we listen to cunning, we become, we lose our chance at mastery. And another one of my favorites, where man is not, nature is barren. Right. But this is I would buy that if it was a bumper sticker slogan. Where man is not, nature is barren. Tell that to PETA, tell that to the global warming theorists, tell it to all the environmentalists. They can pack up their bag. William Blake has put them in their place. Man is noble and is man that supervises and enables growth to occur and abundance to occur in nature. And man is not the enemy, the environmentalists are the enemy. Yeah, they would misunderstand it. Truth can never be told so as to be understood and not be believed. That's number 69. Truth can never be told so as to be understood and not be believed. Any comments on that? Well, I don't think that is true, but he's asking you to leapfrog the quandary. Truth can never be told. He's not saying it can't be known, but it's impossible. I can't possibly describe truth to you or anybody else, but I can adequately show you how to be true to truth. And that can be understood. But the act of believing in something eliminates that possibility entirely. The belief in truth is worthless. It's worse than worthless. It impedes you from arriving at the truth.
Is the example of the bicycle wheel a way to do
it? The bicycle wheel as described at Tesla, yes.
Yeah, and say this is part of the truth.
This is a fragment of the truth.
This
is a glimmer of truth.
Right.
This is a seed.
But the whole wheel is all the truth.
Right.
Which, okay.
Yeah. And then my absolute favorite, I don't know whether you had a chance to read this morning's blog about the mean, but it's titled Enough Already. And it quotes this proverb, enough or too much. He's suggesting that he's probably overdone it. He's probably guilty of excess by doing 70 of these. And it's time to recognize this is enough, probably too much. And we will come back to that later this afternoon. Okay, any further comments? We're at the end of our period, but any last words before we move on? You're fading.
I see. That's like somehow it's complete this point. So sorry, I don't know why. But I said I looked at it on more of a mental level as far as the abundance and the things are enjoying the joy that I was in this country. And with number two, driving the park again.
Fine. Okay. End of period. Moving on. This is our period devoted to thinking, and we're working this year with the ethics of Aristotle. Yes. Anything that is called the ethics or the Nicomachean ethics or the Ethica Nicomachea is what you want. Some of them are just called the ethics of Aristotle. So the exact same thing.
Some of them are free.
I'm sorry?
Yeah.
This is... All 5 days, we're talking about the ethics of... Yeah, I couldn't possibly condense 200 pages of Aristotle into one session. This is just the beginning few pages, so if you haven't started reading for whatever reason, you can easily catch up because we're only doing about the first half of the first book today. The Nicomachean ethics is one of the great wellsprings of Western thought on the subject of law and ethical behavior. Nicomachus was a son of Aristotle, and therefore one might suppose that Aristotle wrote this as a way of teaching his son the basics of his ethical thinking. There are 10 books in the ethics. They were originally 10 separate scrolls, and they're based on lectures that he delivered at the Lyceum. Aristotle completes the chain of thought initiated by Parmenides, focused by Socrates, and developed by Plato. He begins by asserting that every action or line of inquiry a human undertakes is designed to lead to something good. The explorer of oil wants to sell crude oil to a refinery who will convert it into gasoline, which he will sell to motorists who will drive their cars to work or the theater or the grocery store. And so The action of searching for oil leads to three acts of goodness, or three acts we can call good. The driller makes money from taking risk. The refiner makes money from processing the crude oil. And the motorist finds happiness by being able to get to work or to the grocery store or the liquor store or wherever he's going, which will produce goodness in itself. Now, obviously, that's my example, not Aristotle's example. He didn't know anything about oil. The problem is that different people may have different definitions of what is good, and Aristotle talks about this. Clearly, to put this in modern terms, President Obama has a different idea as to what is good for the economy than the Speaker of the House does. So a large part of the exploration of ethics is going to be A, arriving at a common definition, and B, understanding how people come to embrace this common definition. So already we're going back to the idea that we talked about with the problem of learning to read, is that the problem of reading Aristotle is to try to come to an understanding of what he meant. And most people bring their own preconceived ideas and notions into play as they read Aristotle, and they interpret it to justify their own perspective. Now, we don't have to agree with Aristotle. I don't agree with Aristotle on many points that he makes. The point of reading this is to see how he carefully peels back the onion and reveals the inner nature of ethics. I'm not trying to make you Aristotelians, but this is a tremendous tool for understanding how ethics develop and what it means to talk about ethics. Obviously, differences between the Republicans and Democrats about law and ethics is vast. Not everybody has the same thoughts about ideas. That isn't to say that they're both equally wrong or they're both equally right. It's just a fact. And so Aristotle suggests that specific professions, again, to use an example of my own, a profession such as engineering, the people in that profession will have achieved mastery, and they will tend to agree that a good bridge is one that does not collapse when used, rather than one that looks beautiful but can't support any weight. See, that's a common definition of good bridge, bad bridge in engineering. A bridge that collapses is definitely bad. But a bridge that is functional and holds weight, even if it's ugly, aesthetically, is going to be a better bridge than one that is beautiful that collapses. So the idea of good is affected by the notion of usefulness. In the arts, it may be that the mavens of the art world all agree that Picasso is the greatest artist of the 20th century, but does that make his artwork great or even good or even worthwhile looking at? There's a consensus of those that claim to be in the know that he is the great artist of the century. But is he? Will his art endure? Does his art reveal the light of inspiration? In literature, how about the writings of Ernest Hemingway or F. Scott Fitzgerald? Are they great because, or an even better example, in Back to School, Rodney Dangerfield is, or the character he plays, is assigned to write a paper on the meaning of Kurt Vonnegut's novel, so he hires Vonnegut to write a paper for him. It's called delegation. It works in business, it doesn't work so well in academics, but he gets a bad grade, not because he cheated, but because the professor didn't think Vonnegut knew what he was talking about. Of course, he didn't know it was Vonnegut writing the paper. So, we have a lot of the people who make these decisions for us and sculpt the educational curriculum are pointy-headed intellectuals who don't have any taste or understanding of enlightenment. I would say that the works of Talbot Munday and Kenneth Morris are far more important in terms of reading than anything F. Scott Fitzgerald wrote or Ernest Hemingway. Ditto Leonard Merritt. All people that, the vast majority of people, unless you read Sophie, you never hear about it. Now, in politics, Aristotle suggests the good must be defined by what is best for the state and its citizens, not just one class, such as the middle class or the poor, but everyone. Even the rich have a legitimate right to be treated, to be considered in what is good for the state. If you pit one class against another, if you say that the poor must always get the advantage over the rich because the rich already have an advantage, then by Aristotle's definition, this is not good because it's not good for everyone involved. And I would broaden this definition even further. The ideal of politics is to take whatever action or policy is best for everyone concerned, including the inner spirit of the nation. So it's not just what's good for the poor or good for the rich or good for Republicans or good for Democrats. It's what is best for everyone involved, every American citizen, and what is best for the spirit of America. So we can take this and have a discussion here. What is the best course for everyone involved in handling the debt ceiling crisis? What is the best course of action for the spirit of America? Any suggestions? Speak up, can't hear you. Well, all right, I'm not sure the liberals would agree that that's good for anybody. I'm not saying you're wrong, I'm just playing devil's advocate here. All right, I won't argue with that. Other comments or input here? What's the consequence of not extending the debt ceiling? No. I'm asking what the real consequence is. We know that there are all kinds of dire predictions of collapse and chaos. What would be the consequences? Just the very pragmatic consequence of keeping the debt ceiling where it is.
Well, we would have to learn to live within our means.
Right. In other words, we would have to learn to get along on $2.3 trillion a year, which is the income to the government, rather than $3.6 trillion. We'd have to cut about a third of the budget out. Now, can that be done? Is there any historical precedent for doing this?
One thing that has come out of all this, which is amazing to me, is how many non-essential people the government has working for it.
Okay. In case you didn't hear that, Rose pointed out that as we talk about who will get cut, we discover, because they're non-essential, that the government employs about 30% of its workforce is the employment of non-essential people.
Also waste projects, like just going nowhere and people taking airplanes and people going railroads and things that aren't used.
And outright fraud. Medicare and Medicare are riddled with outright fraud.
Death by a third back in the
20s? Actually, it was Warren Harding.
Oh, was it Warren Harding?
And Calvin Coolidge. After Harding died, Calvin Coolidge continued it. And so there is a precedent. The budget was, he inherited a huge debt load from Woodrow Wilson, and where the spending exceeded the income by 50%. And in less than 2 years, Harding cut one-third of the federal budget. He just stopped spending money. And that meant layoffs and firings and the end of programs and this, that, and the other thing. And it created a decade of unparalleled prosperity. The lamestream media fails to report this, of course.
Well, and also, nobody's reminding us in the news, anyhow, that didn't we just raise this a year and a half ago?
Yeah, we raised it about a year ago, and we raised it by a couple of $1 trillion.
And the money's all gone.
Right. So raising the debt ceiling, I don't mind having a small increase in the debt ceiling, say $400 or $500 billion, so that the Treasury Secretary has a little wiggle room. But it has to be clear that that's the absolute last time and that trillions of dollars have to be cut from the budget in order to bring this into balance, because there will not be another debt ceiling increase.
Well, this is for both sides. You're saying something that both sides can look at. It's inviting Americans to spend money that they can't afford, and that's what they want to restructure its tax system. No matter which way it goes, it's to restructure it. I think
right.
Both sides agree that the tax structure is crazy.
That would be a benefit. However, that is a solution, but the real solution is the elimination of unnecessary spending and making that a realistic proposition. Yes.
Another issue that has come out through this is that in past they have agreed to make cuts, and then somehow they just never get cut.
Right. The Democrats have agreed with the Republicans on certain cuts.
And then
that happened in Reagan's time, and the cuts were never implemented.
Yeah.
And we have to be, it's now up to the people to insist on fiscal responsibility.
And to be vigilant and make sure they do what they say, what they agree to.
Okay. So it certainly holding tough and insisting on cuts is the best course for everyone involved. If the debt ceiling isn't raised, it's not necessarily the end of the world. It may be the beginning of a new era. Let's apply this same criterion of what's in the best interest of everyone to education. What is the goal of education? What is the ultimate good education that or what is the ultimate good that education provides to society?
That everyone is a lifelong learner.
Okay. I like that.
And that the children are taught how to think on their own.
Children are taught how to think on their own. They're taught how to respond to the evocation of the soul. We can call it higher intelligence. Yes.
Thank you.
So you're suggesting that the good that education performs is to create jobs for teachers? No, that's the only conclusion we can draw from what you're saying, isn't it? Right. So we can instantly see that that's not good for everyone. It's good for teachers. But basically it means that the Obama education plan is welfare for teachers. It's not welfare for the whole country, it's welfare for teachers. Well, that too. But it's... Yeah, I understand. Okay, that's a good point. Thank you. Good point. So we can instantly see that that's not what education is supposed to be doing. And we can conclude that the federal involvement in education is far more a curse on quality education than a blessing. So the first step that we should be taking in terms of reforming education is to get the federal government the hell out of it. The second step is to get the state government the hell out of it. It should be returned entirely to individual communities if we have public education at all. There is the overriding question of why do we have socialist education in a capitalist society? And that's what public education is. It's socialist education. And it... I'm sorry? Thank you. I want to highlight Aristotle's quote of Plato. Are we on our way from or to the first principle? In any of these discussions, debt ceiling, education, are we on our way to or are we retreating from first principles? What are the first principles? What does it mean to be heading toward first principles or moving away from them? Aristotle suggests that we must know something before we can think about it, even first principles. We have to know that there is something called joy before we can think about joy. So the best thinker, according to Aristotle, is a well-educated one under his very limited definition of a well-educated or a good education. But does public education guarantee the ability to think? Does even private education in the modern world guarantee the ability to think? Or does education perpetuate ignorance? It indoctrinates, it perpetuates dead bones. Reminds me of the old spiritual, dead bones, gonna rise again. If education perpetuates ignorance, for example, back 500 years ago, based on Aristotle and the church, for about 1,000 years, the commonly accepted science was that the earth is flat. Education perpetuated that ignorance in the name of illumination. What is modern education doing that is the equivalent of perpetuating the flat earth concept?
That education is free.
That education is free? That's a new ha-ha. Ah, the greening of America, yes. I would agree with that. Perpetuation of bonehead science. What else? Yeah. Okay. Well, I'm sorry? Okay, the separation of church and state definitely has become a prevailing wind which blows nothing but ignorance. Good. Anybody else?
Well, that article and the idea that science, or something else.
Well, go ahead.
That article I read you the other day where those scientists were
right
looking for answers in forbidden areas, and that the idea that science itself would have any forbidden areas that they will not look at, and in fact, ridicule other scientists who are willing to look at it.
Right. Science imposes limits, not opens doors.
They should be absolutely open.
Somebody else had something they were saying? Self-esteem don't hurt anybody's feeling. Yes, I think Blake would dismiss that with a proverb or two. Yes, these are all examples of how education is fomenting ignorance, not opening up young minds to new growth. Good. Yes. Bill? Well, and the reason why is it's not challenging people to think, students to think. Good. Okay. Aristotle quotes Hesiod, "Far best is he who knows all things himself. Good be that hearkens when mine counsel right. But he who neither knows nor lays to heart another's wisdom is a useless wight." That's the translation I have. So, he's quoting the fact that the person who is able to know things in his own mind through direct perception is the best educated person. Second to that is people who have a good basis and understand the difference between usefulness and a lack of utility. But the vast majority of people neither know nor lay to heart the wisdom of others, and they're just useless. Aristotle then goes on to opine that there are three types of human life. There's the crass, the political, and the contemplative. We could compare this to the three gunas of Hindu philosophy, the inertia, the rapid movement, and the balance. The crass life is one of survival instinct and selfishness. The political is one that interacts with others, often to manipulate them. And the contemplative is driven by higher spiritual ideals and seeks to define what is best for everyone before acting. Aristotle then rejects wealth as necessarily good, as well as health. It's a means for support, not an end of itself. It's a means for life, not an end of itself. We may presume the same to apply to power and fame. They can be curses as readily as blessings. And when they're loved for themselves, they become attachments. Aristotle distinguishes between goodness and utility. The usefulness of an act or idea does not make it good. However, its ability to promote the interests of the whole does qualify it as good. I would add that if something promotes the growth of the whole, it is good. If it obstructs the growth of the whole, it lacks that element of goodness. Okay, any final thoughts on this introduction to Aristotle's ethics? We'll continue on Wednesday and Friday, and then the last 2 days as well. But we're nearing the end of our session. Any final thoughts? Right. We mistreat our children as if learning is automatic. Okay, very good. Before we break here, we'll break for a couple hours. The first hour and 15 minutes is for lunch. And then from 1:15 to 2, I want you to work on an independent research project. You'll continue this work all 5 days of the class, which means you have 3 weeks to research and write something about this. There are a number of divine laws that govern human behavior. I will assign each one of you a law to explore, study, and formulate a plan for expressing in your life. These are all laws defined by DK somewhere. So part of your research can be finding his definition of working with that. Mary, I want you to work on the law of economy. Louise, the law of cause and effect. Mimi, the law of evolution. Nancy, the law of sacrifice. Rose, the law of magnetism. Bill, the law of vibration. Anne, the law of fixation. Donna, the law of freedom. Betty, the law of analogy. Dorothy, the law of inward parts. And the other two assignments are I'll give separately to people who are taking this by podcast, Leslie and Alex. So, yes. The law of fixation. Fixation. FIXATION.